that he keep his voice down, and whispered,
"What is a hubba-ho?"
Baffling. Hubba-ho was a piece of black street argot, peculiar to Oakland, which he had heard for the first time 3 nights ago while in his cell.
"Who'd you hear say that?"
Jill's whisper was so low he could barely make it out over this crude telephone.
"What's it mean, Conrad?"
He studied her face. She seemed frightened.
"Well," he said, "a hoe is a whore, and a hubba-ho.
You ever see a piece of hubba-bubba gum?" She shook her head.
"I bet you have. You just don't remember the name. You know those little pieces of gum? Well, they look like a chunk of crack.
The drug." She nodded. Puzzled, he watched her face. "One visit per week, 30 minutes. And we're talking about hubba-hos." Nevertheless, he went on. "A hubba-ho is a whore who hangs around crack houses, and, like, they're addicts. They trade sex for a chunk of crack or a smoke on a crack pipe. Or at least that's what I was told." He motioned back over his shoulder to indicate the innards of the jail. "Who told you about a hubba-ho?" Now Jill lifted her shoulders, as if to shield her voice from prying ears. She lowered her head so far she had to turn her eyes up to look at him. Her irises peeked out from beneath her upper lids.
"I was standing in line out there, Conrad."
A quavering whisper.
"You've never seen such people. All these—"
She broke off and closed her eyes tightly and seemed to be about to cry.
"All these women."
It seemed that just now, while she was standing in line in the jail yard, waiting to enter the building, the woman in front of her had a 4 or 5-year-old girl in tow who kept running off to explore the yard. The woman kept yelling at her to no avail. Finally, she ran after her and pulled her back to the line, jerking her arm and shrieking and threatening to hit her. Then she seized her by both shoulders and began shaking her. She shook her so hard the woman standing behind Jill began screaming at the first woman to stop before she hurt the child. The first woman turned on her accuser.
"You mind your own damn business, you old hubba-ho!"
She kept repeating this imprecation, "hubba-ho," until the second woman began firing back.
"Who you calling a hubba-ho, you old fucked-over toss-up?"
In no time the slanging match swelled up into a frenzy. "Hubba-ho! Fucked-over toss-up! Hubba-ho! Fucked-over toss-up!" Jill was shocked, appalled, and caught between the two of them. She wanted to flee, and yet she didn't want to lose her place in line. Finally, the first woman was drowning out her challenger. The furious cry, "Hubba-ho!" filled the yard, the sky, the cosmos. "Hubba-ho! Hubba-ho! Hubba-ho! Hubba-ho!" The two women were about to come to blows when a man in uniform stepped in and told them to quiet down. Jill had been terrified. She was still shaken. With an elaborate dumb show, much motioning of her head and rolling of her eyes, she indicated that the first woman, she who had kept screaming, "Hubba-ho!" was seated to her immediate right. She was the one who had come to visit Rotto.
"Conrad," she said, "who are these people?"
Her face was twisted with anguish. Conrad looked at her helplessly. He was stupefied by the turn their conversation had taken. The minutes were rolling by. Finally he said,
"I don't know. They're the same people as the ones in here, I guess. Except that they're women. Be thankful they weren't the men, that's all I can tell you."
Immediately it occurred to him that might sound like a bid for sympathy. And then he wondered why he was so wary of seeking sympathy from his own wife. And he wasn't sure he wanted to know the answer. So he said,
"Tell me about Carl and Christy." "Carl and Christy?"
She looked at him as if this were an astonishing change of subject.
"Are they okay?"
Long pause.
"Yes, they're okay.
He stared at her imploringly, desperate to hear that the children asked about him, talked about him, missed him, loved him, longed for him, even though he also wanted to hear that they were at peace and happy and believed the story they had decided upon, which was that he was off on a trip.
"You might have called," she said. "Jill, there's two telephones. I can't get near them."
He started to tell her about the Pod Room and the Black Faction and the Nordic Bund and how they control the two public telephones. But he decided not to, on the chance that Rotto might possibly overhear. He pulled the telephone's mouthpiece close to his lips and said,
"There may be a few white inmates who can use them, but I'm a—"
He started to say, "new fish," but thought better of that, too.
"I'm new here, and I can't get near them."
"Well," said Jill, "if you want to know the truth about your children—"
"We're going to have to move in with my mother, Conrad."
"You know how wonderful that's going to be? You know how big her place is? You know how happy—" She broke off. She lowered her eyes. She heaved a big sigh. When she looked up, there were tears in her eyes.
"I have no money, Conrad. What am I supposed to do? Live in a duet in Pittsburgh next to a bunch of those people and go on welfare? Or you want me to park the children in that daycare center where all the kids have strep throat and impetigo and head lice and try to get some job that's not going to pay enough in the first place? You tell me which."
Conrad was speechless. Tears were rolling down her cheeks, when all at once she glanced to one side in alarm. At that moment Conrad heard a baritone voice rising in volume.
"Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, baby. You got it, you got it. You do it, you do it. Oh, how you do it, sugar."
It was Rotto. Conrad risked a glance. The big man held his telephone to his ear with one hand, and had the other hand cupped over his groin, while he thrust and swiveled his pelvis as he sat on the stool.
"Conrad," said Jill, "what is this woman doing?"
Her eyes were darting back and forth from Rotto's girlfriend to Conrad's face.
"I don't know," said Conrad, even though he had a pretty good idea. "She has her legs spread," whispered Jill,
who now ducked her head down very low and leaned forward until her nose was almost up against the window.
"And she's touching herself and moaning."
Conrad shook his head as if in consternation. In fact, he now knew for sure. He had already heard about it more than once. It was called beavering. The inmates' girlfriends arrived for the visit wearing miniskirts and no underpants. Then they hiked up the skirts, spread their legs, bared their crotches, and went through the motions of sexual ecstasy. Jill put her hand over her eyes and shook her head. When she took her hand away, her face was contorted and streaked with tears. She said softly,
"I can't stand this. Please don't cry. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say."
Bewildered,
"What are you doing here?"
At first he couldn't figure out what she meant.
"Doing here?"
Accusingly.
"They offered you probation."
"We've already been over this 100 times, said Conrad. All the while he could hear Rotto going,
"Tuh, tuh, tuh, honey pie, you're the one. You're the one. Don't stop. Don't stop."
"How could I plead guilty? I wasn't guilty of anything. They wanted me to plead guilty." "Yes," said Jill, her eyes wide with dismay and exasperation, "to a misdemeanor." "To assault," said Conrad, "but I didn't assault anybody. They assaulted me. I only kept them from hurting me and destroying our property." "But you jumped over their fence, Conrad. That was trespassing. After that, anything—"
She lowered her eyes and shook her head over the uselessness of rehashing it. When she looked up, she was crying once more.
"All right, Conrad, you were totally innocent. So what have you gained by insisting on that?" What did you gain by going through a trial? They were willing to give you probation. They were willing to give you a break. I don't understand you.
Rotto was going,
Do it, sugar. Do it, sugar. Do it, sugar. Do it, sugar. Do it, sugar.
Jill's eyes kept darting to one side and back again. Chastened by her tears, Conrad said softly,
You're right. I didn't gain anything. I didn't think any jury would ever convict me, because I knew, and I still know, I was innocent. But they did, and I lost. I lost a lot. But I kept something, Jill. I kept my honor, and I didn't bargain away my soul.
Incredulous.
Your soul? Well, hats off to your soul. We're all very proud of your soul. Did your soul by any chance stop to think about your son and your daughter and your wife? That's all I was thinking about, Jill. When the time comes, I want to be able to look Carl and Christy in the eye and say I was innocent. I was falsely accused. I refused to compromise with a lie. I went into prison, but I went into prison a man, and I came out of prison a man.
A mirthless smile took over Jill's face. She began shaking her head, and then the tears began again. Rotto was going,
Keep on, keep on, keep on, keep on, keep on, baby, keep on, baby, keep on, baby, keep on, baby, keep on, baby.
Please, don't cry, Conrad pleaded over the telephone.
Pleaded. Rare indeed is the male soul so staunch that it can withstand a woman's tears.
This is better for them?
Jill said in a pathetic, broken voice.
It's better for their souls? It's better that they know you're in jail for felonious assault? Their father's a convict? What kind of big favor have you done them, for God's sake?
Rotto was going, Conrad lowered his eyes and then hung his head. He felt as if the ground had been cut out from under him. All at once his rationalizations, his principles, his soul, seemed like the emptiest propositions imaginable. His soul. The very idea began to seem like a foolish delusion. His soul, if there was such a thing, was losing its last tie to all that was good and sane. He looked up again at Jill. She was sobbing silently, the telephone still at her ear. His peripheral vision detected the huge form of Rotto rising up from his stool. Thank God the man was leaving. He let out a sigh of relief. Then he felt a tap on his shoulder. He looked up. Rotto was looking down at him, smiling. He seemed immense, staring down that way.
"Hi, Conrad," he said. How you doing, bro?
A red alert burst forth from somewhere inside Conrad's skull and surged out to the surface of his skin until the very pores of his scalp felt like little fiery craters. He said nothing. He looked away and tried to concentrate on Jill's face.
Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?
This man, this brute Rotto, knew his name. How? Why?
Or was it all too obvious why? In Santa Rita for only 10 days, but long enough to know that the last thing any young inmate in the pod wanted to do was to attract the attention of someone like Rotto. Conrad kept his gaze fixed on Jill. She was crying. Her lips were moving. The sound of her voice was running through the receiver at his ear, but he had completely lost track of what she was saying.
At least ask him, Conrad.
The look on her face was begging him. But begging him to do what? Ask who? Something about the lawyer Minot. But he had lost the thread.
Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?
His heart was racing. He felt feverish. What was it Jill was talking about? Minot? The lawyer Minot? Minot the lawyer had gone through his pitiful savings. His last $2,900, like that, in a snap of the fingers. and that was all that Lawyer Jack Minette wanted to know about Conrad Hensley.
"Will you?"
Jill beseeched him. "I will," said Conrad.
"You don't mean it. You're just saying that."
It was true. He was just saying that. He was so rattled by what the brute Rotto had said, he could barely think of anything else. Finally, he said,
"Did you get a chance to send the book?"
Jill gave him a puzzled look, an exaggerated expression that seemed to ask,
"What's that got to do with what we're talking about?"
"The Stoic's game," said Conrad.
"Did you have any luck?"
The Stoic's Game was a new novel by a writer of spy thrillers, an Englishman named Lucius Toombs, whose work Conrad particularly enjoyed. Jill sighed.
"Yes, I sent it. Or they sent it. The bookstore sent it. A week ago. $30, by the way, plus the postage."
Jail regulations forbade inmates from receiving books unless bookstores or publishers did the packaging and mailing. Conrad sensed her exasperation, but plowed on.
"We just sit in the cell for hours at a time, and then we go to this place, this sort of recreation room, the pod room, and then we just sit there. I'm going crazy. You can get books from a sort of bookmobile, but it's all trash."
He was conscious of how nervous he had become.
"Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?"
Jill said, "I sent the book. And you have something to do, Conrad. You've got to talk to Mr. Minette."
Conrad opened his mouth and, instead of speaking, breathed very deeply and nodded yes.
"Please don't just yes me," said Jill. "I don't understand you. I don't know what's happening to us. I talked to my mother about it, and she thinks I shouldn't even wait. I'm gonna wait, Conrad, but can't I have some little shred of hope?"
"Wait? As opposed to what?" he wondered. And then the drift of it dawned on him. In California, a felony conviction was automatic grounds for divorce. A sickening feeling came over him. He tried to smile.
"To tell you the honest truth, I don't know.
I don't know what hope there is at this point.
I made a decision, and it may have been the wrong decision, but I made a decision, and here I am. I honestly don't know what can change that. I love you. I love Carl. I love Christy. And I did what I thought was the honorable thing. There's either some hope in that or there isn't."
Jill's eyes filled with tears, and her lips and chin began trembling, and then the tears began flowing down her cheeks.
"I'm not trying to get sympathy, Jill. That's exactly what I feel, and I don't know what else to tell you."
He lifted his hand helplessly, and then let it fall into his lap. Jill was still sobbing, soundlessly, when a deputy cut in on the line to tell them time was up. Conrad couldn't believe it. He felt as if 2 minutes had gone by. All that time spent talking about hubba hose. Holding the telephone close to his lips, he said to Jill,
"Tell Carl and Christy you talk to me, will you?"
She nodded.
"Tell them I love them very much. Tell them I think about them all the time."
She nodded again. He paused and gazed at her, not so much longingly as helplessly.
"I'll see you next week."
He knew the expression on his face had turned it into a question. She nodded again. She didn't say anything. Conrad said,
"I love you, darling."
Ever so softly, Jill said into the telephone,
"I love you."
Then she hung up the receiver and, still sitting there, stared at him with her lips tightly compressed. What did they mean, those compressed and despairing lips? What was he to conclude? He brought his fingertips to his lips and threw her a kiss and lifted both hands, still holding the telephone, to show her he would embrace her if he could.
She brought her fingertips to her lips, too, but her lips remained compressed. As she turned to go, he had the terrible feeling that he would not see her next Sunday or any Sunday. What future was there but the pod? Where the world shrank until there was no room for speculations about the law, let alone the soul. "Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?" The old barracks at Santa Rita were built like barns, with big, gloomy, dark wooden bays 2 stories high. The cells were unlike any jail cells Conrad had ever heard of. They were stalls, or perhaps the word was sties, since, as on many pig farms, they were made of a dirty beige concrete and plaster. Each cell was about 5 by 9 feet, barely big enough for a double-decker metal bunk, bolted to the floor, and a unit-welded metal toilet and basin ensemble. There were no windows, and the door was a solid slab of wood, like a ship's hatch, painted black, with a slot for passing in food. Instead of a ceiling, each cell had a heavy wire screen for a cover. The inmates were like lizards in those boxes or the terrariums children get from pet shops, the ones with the screens over the top. When you looked up through the screen, you saw the underside of a wooden catwalk, where the deputies patrolled, peering down at the creatures below. Somewhere above the catwalks were clerestory windows for light and air. A few ancient, belt-driven attic fans were always grinding and screeching away, but the heat kept pressing down. It never lifted, not even at night. At this particular moment, the screeches of the fans were cutting through the soft, warm soup of a solo by a jazz saxophonist named Grover Washington, piped in over the PA system from an Oakland radio station, KBLX, devoted to classical music and jazz. Whether this was the deputy's idea of soothing the inmates or annoying them, Conrad couldn't figure out. The deputies were all local boys from the sheriff's office, out here in the country, in the Livermore Valley, Okies mostly, but also a few Latinos, whereas the inmates were mainly black youths from the streets of O-Town or Bump City, as they referred to Oakland. O-Town music the deputies detested and resented, and if they were trying to annoy the homeboys by piping in Grover Washington, they were succeeding.
"Motherfucking commute music! Motherfucking weather station! What do they think this is, a motherfucking elevator? Ain't these motherfuckers ever heard of the year 2000?"
Conrad sure was getting tired of this motherfucking word, motherfucking. After 10 days it had begun to beat him down. You couldn't get it out of your head. It rained down from everywhere, from that cell, and that cell, and that cell, and that cell, and that cell way over there. Wherever it came from, you were going to hear it, because there was nothing over anybody's cell but a wire screen. In Santa Rita you heard everything. Motherfuckin' battered every skull and finally penetrated every brain, and then came out of every mouth, or almost every mouth, the whites, the Latinos, the Asians, even the deputies. All this O-Town talk got to the deputies, too. You'd hear some Okie up on the catwalk sound out to another one.
"Yo, Armin Trout, where you at? What's up? What's the motherfuckin' matter now?"
Conrad sat on the concrete floor of his cell with his back against the wall, his knees drawn up, his arms around his knees, his head down, his eyes closed, letting the whole absurd symphony run through his head, trying to keep out every thought.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-boo-ah-oo.
The long, soft, ripe, soupy notes of Grover Washington's saxophone. Scrack, 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 scrack! The grinding screech of the attic fans. Motherfuckin', 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 motherfuckin'. The motherfuckin' chorus of one and all.
Thragoom! Thragoom!
The roar of the toilets flushing. Glug, 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 glug.
the sucking noise they made when they finished flushing. And then, motherfucking, 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 motherfucking all over again. He kept his eyes closed, because if he opened them, things would only get worse. If he opened them, he would see this tiny, filthy sty, this lizard's cage he was trapped in. And he would see his two cellmates, and he would start thinking again. And if he started thinking again, he would have to face again the horrible possibility that Jill was right, that all his posturing about principles had been nothing but that, posturing, that he had ruined his life and hurt those he loved for no other reason than to indulge his obstinate ego, in a world in which principles were dead, and that his descent into this hole, this hell on earth, had been in the name of nothing but vanity and foolishness. No! He had done it for his children. It was an example he would hold up to them proudly, when they were old enough to appreciate what he had done and why he had made such a sacrifice. His eyes closed. He tried to bring Carl's and Christie's faces into his mind, every detail, with utmost vividness. And he couldn't. All that would appear behind his eyelids were a pair of small, vague, pale, ghostly images. Even Jill, whom he had just laid eyes on, was fading fast. He was losing all three of them, even in his own memory. If Jill failed to visit him next Sunday, and the next Sunday, and the next Sunday, if she divorced him, his heart was thrumming. He was abloom with heat and anxiety. The sweat underneath his arms had turned into an oily slick. Gas pains were moving around like a lot of little knives in his bowels. He was aware of the funk of his own body, which was now part of the inescapable odor of Santa Rita, the smell of human beings, the stench of defeat, frustration, anger, aggression, sexual madness, and above all, fear.
"Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?"
Thanks to Santa Rita's chronic overcrowding, he was the third and latest inmate stuffed into a cell that, like all the rest, was only barely big enough for two. His cellmates were an Okie called Mutt and a Hawaiian called Five-O. Both seemed to know their way around jails, and both seemed to wish he would disintegrate. He was a useless new fish who understood nothing about anything, and who, moreover, as the third man in, was to blame for the overcrowding. The Okie, Mutt, had the bottom bunk, and the Hawaiian, Five-O, had the top bunk. And Conrad slept on a mattress on the floor. His cellmates resented the mattress, too. At night it took up all the space between the bunk and the door, and even then had to be folded up against one wall, forcing Conrad to sleep with his legs bent. During the day it went under the bottom bunk, leaving him no place to sit but on the floor. Mutt and Five-O didn't want to see the mattress, and they didn't want to see him. So he sat on the floor with his eyes closed, hoping against hope that the gas pains didn't cause him to have to get up and have some sort of appalling bowel movement 24 inches or so away from these two men, who already resented the mere fact that he existed.
"Motherfucker, Five-O, what the fuck did you just do?"
The outburst was so sudden and loud Conrad opened his eyes. Mutt and Five-O were sitting cross-legged on Mutt's lower bunk. Mutt had removed the shirt of his yellow jail uniform, and Five-O was tattooing a 3-inch-long picture of an AK-47 assault rifle on his chest, just beneath the hollow where the two halves of his collarbone joined, with a sharpened piece of guitar wire.
"Motherfucker hurt like a motherfucker," said Mutt.
"Bummers, man," said Five-O. "I only tryin' for make the bullet clip. Like that, that's why."
"Well then, shit, don't make it like that."
"Ev bombers, man, yeah, but you ever when spark the AK-47, the bullet clip, get scoshy da kinds?"
He described a little curve in the air with his hand.
Like that?
As Conrad had finally figured out in Five-O's Hawaiian dialect, which was called Pidgin, Spock meant inspect or check out. Skoshi meant a little bit. And Dakines meant that kind, like that, or like you know. Mutt was a wiry little man, no more than 140 pounds, if that, with networks of veins protruding on his forearms. He reminded Conrad of Lightbulb, who worked in the freezer unit at Croker Global, except that Mutt had a nervous habit of lowering his eyebrows over and over, which made him look perpetually angry. On one shoulder, he had a tattoo with the legend, "Live to Ride, Ride to Live." Beneath that was a small but extravagantly detailed tattoo of a winged motorcycle ridden by a phantom. On the other shoulder was a tattoo of a death's head wearing a Nazi officer's cap. These were jailhouse tattoos, artfully done, or artfully enough, but all black and marred by welts of colloidal tissue, where they had become infected and healed over. Tattooing was tolerated at the state penitentiaries, but was forbidden at Santa Rita. Mutt and Five-O had solved that problem by sitting on the lower bunk, where the deputies couldn't see them from up above on the catwalk. Conrad judged Mutt to be in his late 30s. Five-O was probably 10 years younger. He was heavy-set, fleshy rather than muscular, with smooth, putty-colored skin, a shock of jet-black hair, and a broad, flat nose. His full lips had a stretch of skimpy mustache running above them, but his wide jaws and well-developed chin pulled all the elements of his face together and gave him a strong, rather handsome look. Conrad had watched him draw the AK-47 with a ballpoint pen on a slip of paper. It was a surprisingly sophisticated piece of work. He had applied a waxy film of roll-on deodorant from the commissary on Mutt's chest and pressed the drawing onto it. When he peeled the paper away, the drawing of the rifle was transferred to Mutt's skin. And he went to work on it, holding the guitar wire like a lancet and pricking out the design in the little Okie's flesh. His concentration was so intense, his eyebrows seemed to wrap around his nose. Conrad was fascinated. He stared at him. Five-O stopped, froze, with his hands poised above Mutt's chest, and turned toward Conrad and glowered with the look that says, "What do you think you're looking at?" Then he growled, "What are you? I owe you money or what?" Mutt turned toward him too, lowered his eyebrows, squinted accusingly, then turned back and said under his breath, "Shit, motherfucker." Conrad shrugged and looked away and closed his eyes again. Despite all their jailhouse bluster, he didn't fear these two men. Mutt, from all he could gather, was a far-gone petty criminal who had been in jails more than he had been out of them, and was currently awaiting trial on a charge of dealing in a drug called crank, a form of methadrine. He claimed to be a member of the Nordic Bund, and perhaps he really was, since he was one of the few white inmates able to penetrate the blacks' control of the two telephones in the pod room. But his tough-guy pose had failed to cover up the fact that he was a nervous wreck, plagued by twitches and tics, and given to stretches of gloomy silence interrupted by bursts of anger. Five-O was in jail on a charge of forgery involving credit cards, and not for the first time, apparently. Having a sound instinct for self-preservation, he, like most knowledgeable Asian inmates who could manage it, had hooked up with a Latino gang known as Nuestra Familia. All such matters of jailhouse manners, mores, and vocabulary Conrad had come to know through Mutt and Five-O's interminable conversations. Cooped up in the cell for hours at a time, they sometimes read books from the bookmobile cart that came around to the pod every 2 weeks. Mutt was reading a novel called Burkitt, about the last days of the Third Reich and Hitler's escape and capture by Stalin, which he devoutly believed to be based on fact. 5-0 was reading a novel called Dr. Snow, about pimps and their bitches, by a writer named Donald Goines. He kept slapping it down on his bunk and saying, "Wow, bummers! What a junk book!" Then he would pick up a tablet of writing paper and a ballpoint pen from the commissary and start drawing stupendously muscular men and women, after the fashion of comic book superheroes. They were grotesque in their extreme muscularity, and yet the big Hawaiian knew his human anatomy. The gods and goddesses kept pouring out of his fingertips, often in attitudes of violent action, involving complex foreshortening. Mutt would pester him for pornographic creations, and occasionally 5-0 would oblige, sending Mutt off into wild cackles of pleasure. And now 5-0 was tattooing an AK-47 for him on his chest, while the two of them continued their verbal chronicle of jailhouse days. 5-0 struck Conrad as a moke, which, he had deduced, was pigeon for an ordinary, low-rent, knockabout fellow. He had gotten in trouble here on the mainland and was scuffling to survive in a bad fix known as Santa Rita. At the moment, as Conrad sat on the floor with his eyes closed, 5-0 and Mutt were discussing jailhouse bodybuilding and the problems it was causing currently in the pod room. The only bathing facility in the pod, 5-0 said, "bafing," was a lineup of showers on one side of the pod room separated from the rest of the room by a waist-high concrete wall with a narrow opening midway. There was no weightlifting equipment at Santa Rita, and so buffed-up cons had taken to standing in the opening and placing one hand on each section of the wall and doing dips, an exercise that pumped up the shoulders, the chest, and the triceps muscles of the arms. The black inmates in the pod outnumbered the white inmates by better than 3-1, and their shot caller, a brute named Vastly, who wore his hair in cornrows with tiny yellow ribbons like a jailhouse crown, was even bigger than Rotto. When the Papalos, black people, were busy doing dips, 5-0 observed, no one else could take a shower. "You try go inside," he said. "You ass out." Ass out was not pigeon. It was the universal Santa Rita term for out of luck. Conrad was curious as to what Mutt's reaction to this declaration of the jailhouse facts of life would be, and so he parted his eyelids slightly, just enough to see without his cellmates realizing he was looking at them.
"Shit," said Mutt. "Any motherfucker tries to keep me out of the motherfucking shower, I'll show you who's ass out."
"Yeah? Then I hope you get plenty lacus, brother."
Get meant have. Lacus meant balls.
"You know that bugger riffraff? That bugger went for try cockroach slip. On by one them big papalos for go inside and chee! Vastly them broke his face for him. They bust up that bugger."
He made a gesture with one hand over the biceps of his other arm to indicate how big the muscles of Vastly and them were.
"Fuck doing dips and all that shit," Mutt said with infinite disgust. "You want to know what'll pop all those motherfucking inflated muscles real fast?"
"What?"
"A length of metal, 5-0. Give me a shank, and I'll go up against any pumped-up ugga-bugga in this whole motherfucking jail."
He closed his fingers and gave his hand a sudden twisting thrust, as if shoving a knife into someone's solar plexus. Just then there was a clack at the door, the sound of a deputy sliding open the slat that covered the food slot.
"Hensley!"
Conrad looked up. He could see part of the deputy's face peering in.
"You got a package."
Conrad got up and, with a single step, was at the door. Through the slot he could see the deputy, a pale, stout Okie with big arms bulging out of his short-sleeved gray uniform blouse. The man was opening the zip strip on a padded manila envelope. He withdrew a book, Conrad barely had time to make out the word Stoics on the jacket before the deputy removed the jacket and tucked it under his arm, along with the padded envelope. Then he seized the book's hard front cover with his right hand and, without another word, began shaking it for all he was worth. The pages and the back cover flapped about violently. Conrad was appalled. The binding would be torn to bits. The deputy suddenly stopped flailing the thing and looked at Conrad through the slot.
"You can have the book, but you can't have this."
He nodded toward the hard cover, which he still gripped, holding it up at eye level. So saying, he seized the pages of the book with his other hand and hunched over, and, with a furious grunt, ripped the front cover off, and then the spine, and then the back cover. When it was all over, his face was red, and he was breathing hard. He held up the remains, a pathetic stack of folios that were coming apart, with clots of glue sprouting all over the place.
"Okay, this is yours."
He passed the stricken clump through the slot, and Conrad took it.
"Next time whoever sent you this, you tell 'em you want paperbacks."
Then he walked away. Conrad stood there for a moment, holding what was left of this grossly violated object. He was shocked. Somehow he had been terribly degraded and humiliated. Such a gratuitous, utterly pointless exercise of power. My book! Still holding the sheaf of paper chest high, he turned and looked at his two cellmates, halfway expecting some expression of sympathy, despite their obvious resentment of his very existence. Both were watching him from the lower bunk.
"Motherfucker," said Mutt. But not to Conrad.
He was now looking at 5-0.
"I'd like to get my hands on that motherfucking book cover. Talk about shanks, man. It don't have to be metal long as it'll go in. I learned that the first day I ever spent in jail. I was..."
He stopped. He looked off, as if he were gazing into the distance instead of at a filthy beige wall 2 feet away. Then he glanced at Conrad. Conrad averted his eyes and stepped back toward the wall and sat down on the floor again and looked at the remains of the book, as if he was about to start reading it. Holding the folios together with his left hand, he turned the first page with his right. It was the blank sheet that began the book. Next came a page with the title. Only that, the title. The Stoics. How strange. It didn't say the Stoics game, and Stoics didn't have an apostrophe. Mutt resumed.
"I was just a kid," he told 5-0. "I was 17, but I must have looked 12. I don't reckon I weighed 110 pounds, and they threw me in a cell with 3 of these big buffed-up motherfuckers."
He made the same motion over his biceps that 5-0 had made in describing Vastly and his retinue.
"3 Popolos?"
"Nah, they was 3 white motherfuckers. First thing I know, they jumped me. And 2 of those buffed-up motherfuckers, they hauled me down. And the 3rd one, he tries to rape me."
He stopped again. Another long pause.
"Shit. He did rape me, 5-0. He did rape me. The other 2 of 'em, they had my arms and legs pinned down. And there wasn't 1 goddamn thing I could do about it. I was 17 years old. And then they took a nap, all 3 of 'em, just like they'd all had themselves a nice big meal. Well, 1 of those motherfuckers had a book just like that motherfucking book he got, with the stiff cover. And the front of it was practically tore off the rest of it. So I tore it off the rest of the way, quiet as you please. And I started bending that cardboard while they were sleeping. Like this here."
He pantomimed bending the cardboard back and forth with his hands.
"I worked me loose a piece of it about like this here."
He made a wedge shape with his forefingers. Then I started bending that piece of cardboard the long way until I had me a double-thick piece like this here. With his fingers he described a long, narrow triangle, the shape of a dagger. Then I took it around the big end like this here. He clenched his fingers in the air, as if holding a knife. And I leaned over that big motherfucker, the one that had had me. And I, so help me Christ, Five-O, I drove that cardboard shank right in his motherfucking eye. With that he brought his clenched hand down with such ferocity that Five-O drew back on the bunk. Mutt's outcry was so loud it was no doubt heard in every cell in the pod.
"Gee," said Five-O. "What happened then, brother?"
Mutt was now leaning forward on the bunk, his arms and his bare torso rigid. His eyes were blazing with the recollection of that incident long ago.
"That motherfucker. He wakes up screaming, and there's blood spouting through his fucking fingers where he puts them over his eye. And he looks up at me with the other eye, and I was glad he could look up and see it was me who done it, because that was the last thing that motherfucker ever got to use his eyes for except to cry his fucking guts out, because, Five-O, then I drove that cardboard shank through that motherfucker's other eye!"
He brought his hand down again, and Five-O flinched again, and a chorus started up from the cells all around.
"Who's that talking all that eyeball shit? Where's that cardboard J-Cat at?"
"You, motherfucker, shut up or I'm going to shove that cardboard of yours up Mr. Brown!"
These messages, over the wire, as it was known, riled Mutt up still further, until he was leaning toward Five-O like an animal about to pounce.
"It was nothing but a piece of cardboard off a book, Five-O, but it was the sweetest shank I ever had. Ain't no metal worker in the world ever made a sweeter one. It was sweeter than if I'd killed the motherfucker. That motherfucker, if he's still living, then all he is one miserable goddamn shuffling gimp-along gork with poached eggs for eyes. And fuck him. Ain't no motherfucker in no motherfucking jail ever tried to fuck with me again."
The chorus swelled up anew.
"Yo, Superman, kiss my sweet ass. Who's that J-Cat? Cat got cardboard for brains. That cat's got a reservation in the rubber room. That's what he's got."
The mere memory of the rape had already roused Mutt to a manic intensity. The mockery and laughter of the chorus of black voices now pushed him to the edge. You had only to look at him to see that. He jumped off the bunk and looked up through the screen, his lips parted and his teeth showing, breathing rapidly. You could tell he was about to deliver a message to the world, which he now did.
"So don't try to tell me some bunch of buffed-up niggers gonna keep me out the shower!"
That did it.
"Hey, who used the N-word? Who's the motherfucker said that? That J-Cat motherfucker just used the N-word! Yo, deputy, better pack that motherfucker off to Wackyville or he's dead meat."
The cries rose from cells all over the pod. A regular ruckus it was. Conrad no longer pretended to look at the book. He sat upright in a state of alarm. The N-word was the most taboo word at Santa Rita, if you were white.
"Where's that J-Cat at? What's his motherfucking cell number?"
J-Cat was the jailhouse lingo for a crazy person. Many Santa Rita inmates were first sent to the state prison facility at Vacaville, up in the Napa Valley, for psychiatric evaluation. The Vacaville designation for psychotics was Category J. Homosexuals were Category B. And inmates referred to Vacaville as Wackyville and Faggotville. Well, maybe Mutt was a candidate for Wackyville. Conrad, sitting tensely on the floor, chanced a look at Five-O. Five-O was sitting on the edge of the bunk, not so close to Mutt any longer. He had put the piece of guitar string down. He looked at Conrad. For the first time, with something other than the aloofness of the jailhouse veteran lording it over the new fish. What did Conrad now see? perhaps even a glimmer of the comradeship of two poor devils thrown together. For they were both thinking the same thing. This wound-up little Loki, with half an AK-47 freshly tattooed on his chest, had just snapped. Sure enough, Mutt began raging at his detractors. He threw his head back and screamed up through the screen.
"Who the fuck you talking to, you bunch of motherfucking ugga-buggers?"
Then he started hopping about like a monkey and scratching his ribs with his fingers and screaming,
"Ugga-bugga! Ugga-bugga! Ugga-bugga! Ugga-bugga!"
The roar of the pod was now deafening.
"Hey, knock it off down there!"
It was one of the deputies leaning over the railing of the catwalk. From somewhere, one inmate's voice rose above all the others.
"Tell that racist J-Cat motherfucker knock it off or he gon' get his cap peeled. Gon' peel your cap, motherfucker! Peel your cap! Peel your cap! Peel your cap!"
Kenny. It all came back. On the night Conrad had gotten laid off at Crooker Global Foods, Kenny had come barreling into the parking lot with his brand-new red boombox car thundering out some country metal song called Brain Dead, in which a group called the Pus Casserole kept bawling,
"Peel your cap, I said! Peel your cap, I said! Peel your cap, I said!"
And Kenny, from his eminence as a man of the world, talking to a poor square kid named Conrad Hensley, had informed him this was jailhouse talk. How ironic. How little Kenny actually knew. If Kenny had thought and thought for 1,000 years, he couldn't have imagined being penned up like a lizard at Santa Rita, where people threatened to peel each other's caps with the utmost sincerity. Mutt stood beside the bunk, looking up through the screen, his teeth clenched, his arms out to the side, as if he were ready for a movie cowboy gunfight. He was bare from the waist up. His slim torso was all gristle, nodes, and veins. His eyebrows were flexing up and down at a furious rate. The phantom motorcyclist and the death's head Nazi on his shoulders took on a crazed reality. The AK-47 emblazoned on his chest looked as demented as he did. Half of it was still in the dull black of 5-0's ballpoint rendering. The other half, the half 5-0 had already incised into his skin, stood out in an inflamed red relief. Sweat poured down his face. His half-naked body glistened. He began screaming again.
"Shut the fuck up! Shut the fuck up!"
"Easy, bro," said 5-0. "Cool head, main thing."
But it was no use.
"Shut the fuck up!"
screamed Mutt.
"Or I'm going to put you back on the side of the minute rice box, you bunch of Uncle Bens!"
The ruckus increased. Someone yelled out,
"Motherfucker's dead meat! Dead meat!"
Then it became a chant.
"Dead meat! Dead meat! Dead meat! Dead meat!"
Splat! Something hit the floor of the cell just inches from where Conrad was sitting. Right there. A runny, yellowish, gooey mess. The smell of urine rose up, that and a high sweet smell besides. He jumped up before the pool could spread. Above him, a long, viscous string of goo hung from the screen, gradually lengthening, thanks to its own weight. Bombardment! From an adjoining cell! The Pizooka! The Pizooka was part of the perverse weaponry of Santa Rita. Inmates urinated into plastic shampoo tubes from the commissary, poured in syrup saved up from the morning servings of pancakes, shook it all up, screwed the tops back on, got on the top bunks, and squeezed the tubes to propel the noxious mixture up over the cell walls. Mutt stared at the mess on the floor for a moment, then leaped past Conrad. When he reached the door, he gave it a terrific kick, like a karate kick, with the heel and the sole of his foot. This was a way inmates commonly expressed dissatisfaction. He stopped, stared at the lower part of the door, then began kicking it repeatedly. Bang, 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 bang!
"Yo, Sims, what's the matter with you?"
It was one of the Yoki deputies yelling down from the catwalk.
"What the hell you think you're doing?"
Without looking up, still facing the door, Mutt said, "I want some crank." The deputy said, "You want some crank? Give me some crank, goddammit. Guess what, Sims? Your ass out." A chorus of catcalls and laughter from the other cells. Mutt's face became contorted with rage. "I said I want some crank!" someone yelled. "You can crank my Johnson, dead meat." Raucous laughter. The deputy yelled, "Yo, Sims, look at me." Mutt looked up through the screen, and so did Conrad and 5-0, who had now gotten up off the bunk. They could make out the deputy leaning way over the catwalk railing and looking down at them. "Chill down, Sims," he said. Then he lowered his arm over the railing until his hand was at the level of his groin. He curled his fingers and extended his thumb and began jiggling his hand in the male semaphore that means, "Go masturbate." Apoplectic with rage, Mutt extended his arm and his middle finger toward the deputy, then wheeled about toward the door and began kicking it even more furiously than before. "Bang, bang, 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 bang!" The deputy yelled, "Cut that shit out, Sims! That's an order!" Mutt didn't cut it out. "Fuck you!" He was hammering away at the door with his heel. Another voice from the catwalk, a deeper voice. "God damn it, Sims, cut it out! You want Michael Jackson come get you?" "He he he!" That got a big rise out of the chorus over the wire. "Fuck you!" screamed Mutt to one and all.
"Hey, Mutt," said 5-0, "easy, brah. Cool head, main thing. Let us photo Michael Jackson, that kind."
But Mutt was long past cooling down and taking advice. He was in a frenzy, a rage, which the catcalls from all over the pod only made worse. Conrad and 5-0 had both gravitated toward the other end of the cell, near the toilet and the basin. Presently they could hear the clack of wooden slats being slid shut over the slots in the doors. Only the deputies outside the cell could open or close the slats. They always closed them when they had to remove an inmate forcibly, so that the other inmates couldn't look out and watch. The clacks came closer and closer, and you could hear the sound of a whole group of men speaking in low voices. Mutt stopped kicking the door. Now he just stared at it, but he kept jerking his shoulders and elbows about. Then you could see a pair of eyes at the slot, and a deep, oaky voice said, "Okay, Mutt, I'm going to open this door, and I want you to walk on out like a nice fella."
"Fuck you! You don't call me Mutt! You don't know me! You ain't no friend of mine!"
"Okay, Mutt, you can be Mutt, or you can be Mr. Sims, but I'm going to open this door, and I want you to come on out of there peaceful, like a good fella. Otherwise, you're Mr. Ass Out."
"Fuck you!"
"I don't want to have to bring Michael Jackson in there, Mutt."
Mutt's response to that was to lunge toward the door and spit through the slot.
"Shit, cocksucker," said the deep voice.
Clack. Someone slammed the slat across, closing the slot. The deep voice now came over the door and through the screen.
"Always gotta be the hard way, huh, Mutt?"
Then silence. All three of them, Mutt, 5-0, and Conrad, stared at the door. The cell doors at Santa Rita opened outward and had no handles on the inside, so that the inmates couldn't prevent the deputies from opening them. The entire pod was abnormally quiet. The inmates, or most of them, were confused as to their allegiance. Ordinarily, they were on the side of any other inmate in a set to with the deputies, and all the more so when the issue finally boiled down to brute force. But Mutt was the J-cat who had used the N-word. The fans overhead went scrack, 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 scrack. Grover Washington's saxophone went bahoom, bahoom. Conrad's eyes were pinned on the black door. Suddenly it swung open, revealing a whole gang of deputies in their short-sleeved gray shirts and navy pants. The lead man held a clear plastic riot shield in front of him and had a billy club in his other hand. He was the Okie named Armantrout, and he was the most imposing of the deputies who regularly worked the pod. The short sleeves of his uniform blouse, which had obviously been hemmed still shorter, revealed the sort of massive arms that can come only through weightlifting. His was the deep voice they had already heard. And now that voice said,
"Give it up, Mutt, and come on out of there. Use your head. We won't lay a hand on you long as you use your fucking bean."
Mutt, who was in a crouch, stepped back and then seemed to relax. Nonchalantly, he leaned against the wall at the end of the bunk and folded his arms and bent one knee and propped his foot up on the wall as well.
"Good man, Mutt," said the deputy. "Now just stay cool."
Slouching still farther, Mutt lowered his head and eyed the deputy dubiously, but with no great concern, the way you might check out a stray dog that happened to be walking by. For a few seconds it was a Mexican standoff, with the adversaries looking each other in the eye and doing nothing about it. Behind Armantrout and his shield and his club was another deputy, a lean, rangy Okie with a rubber glove on his right hand. It was a great, ugly, thick, black thing that came all the way up to his elbow. And in that instant Conrad got it. That must be the Michael Jackson, named for the singer whose trademark was a single glove. The rest of the deputies were bunched in the doorway. The cell was too small and crowded for them all to come inside at once. Armantrout took a step forward, his shield before him. And suddenly, more suddenly than Conrad would have thought humanly possible, Mutt sprang off the wall with a kick, the same karate-style kick he had been giving the door. It caught the shield on one edge, spinning the deputy around and knocking him off balance. Mutt was on top of him, in too close for the big man to use either his club or his shield, and he drove his right forearm into the deputy's face and his left forearm into the side of his head across the ear. Stunned, Armantrout staggered, slipped on the bazooka mess, and fell. Blood was streaming out of his nose. Mutt was on top of him. The rangy deputy leaped forward on top of Mutt and clamped his huge gloved hand on Mutt's upper left arm. Mutt's body stiffened. There was a smell of burning flesh. His arm and his shoulder began convulsing, and then his entire body. His eyes rolled back into his head, and his mouth opened, and his tongue filled his mouth like a big fish. He looked like someone having an epileptic seizure. He was sprawled on the floor, on his back, shuddering. His head kept clattering against the metal leg of the bunk. The inflamed red, half an AK-47 on his chest, stood out redder, more feverish, more grotesque than ever. The big deputy, Armantrout, managed to regain his feet. He still had a compulsive grip on his club and his shield. His face was a stream of blood from the nose down, and his nose was swelling up. It looked as if someone had taken a wide paintbrush and stuck it under his nose and painted a swath of red straight down over his chin. There was blood on his blouse and on his chest and chest hair where the blouse was open at the top.
"Oh, you little cocksucker," he said.
And he lifted the club and bent over, as if to smash Mutt in the head. But two more deputies squeezed through the door and restrained his arm.
"God damn it, Army! Motherfucker's out cold!"
The rangy deputy released his grip with the rubber glove on Mutt's upper arm. Conrad could see now that there were two metal prongs sticking out of the palm. However they managed to store it up in the contraption, it had a tremendous electrical charge. Mutt's body was still convulsing and struggling to take in air. The smell of burnt flesh was sickening. They hog-tied Mutt's wrists together behind his back with plastic cinches, and then they hog-tied his ankles together the same way. and then they ran a length of plastic from his wrists to his ankles, so that he wasn't going to hit or kick a living soul if and when he came to. By the time they carried him out, he had grown still. He appeared shrunken. He was so limp and fragile, it was hard to imagine the rage and animal strength that had exploded out of that little creature just a few minutes earlier. The last deputy out of the cell was Armantrout, who now had a handkerchief pressed against his streaming nose. The handkerchief was soaking red, and there was more blood on the back of his right hand and forearm, from where he had first tried to wipe it away from his nose and mouth. Conrad and Five-O couldn't keep their eyes off it. Armantrout must have detected that, because he stopped and stared them down until they looked away. Then he took the handkerchief from his mouth, and, through that mad-dog crimson orifice, in his deepest voice, soaked through with threat, he said, "Shit removal's free of charge around here. Have a nice day." Then he slammed the door shut and locked it. Conrad looked at Five-O. Five-O arched his eyebrows and opened his eyes wide and twisted his lips into a half-smile and began nodding his head slightly, in the way that says,
"Wow! Astounding! What is one to make of all that?"
To Conrad, the man's expression offered hope. Perhaps this big Hawaiian would now stop freezing him out. Perhaps he might even have a cellmate he could talk to. For that reason, not because he had any interest in the answer, he asked,
"Where are they taking him?"
He motioned his head in the general direction of the departed mutt.
"From now," said Five-O, "Armantrout dem going break his face, if I know dem. Then they going throw him in the rubber room."
"The rubber room?"
"Get rubber walls, get rubber floor, like that, for the crazy people. No more blankets, no more bathroom, no more basin, no more nothing. That's why hard, brother. The rubber room stay nails."
Conrad could feel a strange wave spreading through his central nervous system, and he could hear a sound like rushing steam inside his skull. It was the rush of madness, the incorrigible madness of this place. He had just witnessed something horrible. Before his very eyes, barely an arm's length away, a tormented little man had lost his mind and turned into a cornered beast. Then they had attacked and reduced him to a grisly, spastic, convulsive length of live meat burning in the throes of neurons gone amok, and hauled his shriveled carcass off to some madhouse called the Rubber Room. And yet that was the least of it, wasn't it? There was something much worse. His mind fought against sorting it all out and letting it up to the surface. But the wave was irresistible, and he already knew the source of his terror. Live meat, to be devoured. And now he stared the terror right in its filthy face. Mutt Sims. The reduction of that little Oki to such a pitiful state had begun with a homosexual rape in a county jail when he was 17 years old. Not all that much younger than he, Conrad, was now. Such things did happen. In an hour they would be turned out of their cells and into the pod room, where all the mad creatures were thrown together, and it was every man for himself.
"Dead meat! Dead meat! Dead meat! Dead meat!"
"Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?"
Chapter 16. Gotcha Back. At about 7:15 p.m., with Serena in the passenger seat, Charlie drove the Ferrari up the slope of the Piedmont Driving Club's driveway and stopped under the porte cochere, muttering imprecations about Serena and anybody else who might have had anything to do with this useless fucking evening, which was called the Mayfly's Ball. Why did he have to put on a tuxedo and leave home and have dinner with the likes of Tilton and Elaine Lundeen and Freddy and what-the-hell's-his-wife's-name Birdwell and that kid Perkins Knox, who was old Governor Knox's nephew. And what the hell's her name, and Slim, and whatever it is, Tucker, who Serena thought were such a great catch. And pay for it. Pay for it! He had reached that stage of depression in which going out in public seems fraught with the danger of exposing the sorriness of your sorry fucking self to the entire world. On top of that, his right knee was aching so much, just putting on the brakes was a killer. He had even thought of having Serena drive, but that meant that when they arrived here under the porte-cochere, he would have to come teetering out of the car in full view of the club members going in or out of the main door. Poor old bastard has to have his young wife drive for him. How old is he, anyhow? This way, only the parking attendants would notice the old man with the rusting joint. And what difference did they make? Actually, they did make a difference. The egotism of the male of the species is such that he is embarrassed to let another male get an eyeful of his infirmities, no matter who it is. Charlie's plan for exiting the driver's seat was to plant his left foot on the driveway pavement and then thrust himself upright with his arms, so that when he dragged his right leg out of the car, his weight would be fully supported by his left leg and his sound left knee. But when he tried to thrust himself up, he didn't make it and went keeling over backward onto the seat. "Captain Charlie? Don't need anybody's fucking help. Captain Charlie? Stop fucking hovering over me." This time he pulled himself upright by planting his left foot and then grabbing the door frame with both hands. Took forever, plus a lot of trembling of his right arm and shoulder. But he was standing and prepared to go gimping into the Piedmont Driving Club. "Captain Charlie," the parking captain, whose name was Gillette, said once more, "let me give you a hand." Two parking attendants, younger black men, were looking on impassively and no doubt thinking, "These old crocs with their Ferraris and their money." "Thanks anyway, Gillette," said Charlie. "Just don't take up football, Gillette. It always racks you up in the end." It seemed supremely important to let Gillette know that it wasn't age or plain old arthritis that had done this to his knee. It was football, which qualified it as an honorable wound of war. "I don't spec I will, Captain Charlie," said Gillette, shaking his head and smiling and chortling, as if Charlie had delivered one of the funniest lines he had ever heard here at the portals of the Piedmont Driving Club. Gillette made Charlie feel marginally better. Captain Charlie. Charlie couldn't even figure out how the employees here at the club had ever learned that he was called Cap'n Charlie down at Turpentine. But they had, and Cap'n Charlie he was. But then his spirits fell all over again. What if the word concerning Cap'n Charlie Croker gets out to everybody, to all the world? The bank seized his airplane. Who would feel like calling him Cap'n Charlie Croker then? Charlie went limping around the front of the car, not the back, where the lights of the car behind him would illuminate his decrepit old carcass for one and all, and caught up with Serena, who was patiently waiting near the door. The doorman, Gates — Charlie had never known whether Gates was his first or his last name — said, "Evening, Captain Charlie. Evening, Miss Croker." "Evening, Gates. And thank you for not offering to fucking carry me over the threshold or otherwise calling attention to my fucking knee." "Charlie," said Serena, taking his arm as they entered the club, "are you sure you're all right? I've never seen your knee flare up this bad before."
Testily, "I'm fine. And thanks so much for making sure I couldn't fucking set foot inside the club without being reminded of my knee, which, by the way, is a football injury, not arthritis, for your fucking information."
"Why don't you go see M.O. Knuckles again?"
"I don't need to see M.O. Knuckles again. I know exactly what he'll tell me. I need a knee replacement. I don't want a plastic knee."
"Well, it's up to you."
"Thanks. Thanks a lot. And thanks for forcing this stupid evening on me.
I really am going to enjoy an evening with some of the younger crowd, aren't I? That was one of Serena's themes. It was necessary to keep in touch with the younger crowd in order to stay current on the ideas that were circulating. Too bad, sister. You knew how old I was when you married me. Besides, Freddie Birdwell and Tilton Lundeen, Christ, they're children. I doubt that either one of them's 40 yet. I know their goddamn parents. I know their parents a whole lot better than I know them. Ike Birdwell's son and Tilty Lundeen's son saw them when they were still wearing seersucker sunsuits and playing in the sandbox. They're going to have to fight the impulse to call me Mr. Croker. Mutter, 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 mutter. As a piece of architecture, the driving club was one surprise after another. Visually, it unfolded like the chambers of a nautilus. Because of its position on a hill, it was impossible to grasp the size of the place as you drove up. Neither the porte cochere nor the main entrance was very imposing. The rough stone of which the porte cochere was made gave it a rustic rather than a grand look. The main entrance opened into a hallway of adequate, but by no means elegant, proportions. The surprises lay beyond. The original building, back in 1887, had been a farmhouse,